We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Arsenal may be struggling to hit the goal at the moment, but not our fundraiser. This is the Arsenal Vision Post-Match Podcast. My name is Alex Smith, the Blackman, Twitter, Yankee Gunner. You know, it is absolutely the case that when things are a bit shit on the pitch, we tend to, well, let's just say it, shit on each other, right? Social media gets a bit spiky. Podcasts can get a bit spiky. It's all a little bit difficult. And seeing as how it's a difficult enough time in the world, you can understand how the discourse can deteriorate. But the funny thing is, like, fundamentally, while social media can be a bit of a mess, actions speak a hell of a lot louder than words. And the actions of so many of you, hundreds of you, have spoken because, and we will continue this all month. As you know, last week on this day, at this time, we announced a fundraiser for the Arsenal Foundation. And our prior fundraiser had been £10,000. So we set out to double that. Our goal was to hit £20,000. Now, candidly, I had no idea, you know, achievable, not achievable, who knows? Well, we are now 1 week later at 106% to that goal with £21,222 at the time of recording this. And, you know, I'm not going to go on and on about it. The fact is, it's just incredible. It means the world. You know, I said we're going to thank everybody individually, and we're going to do that. I'm going to take a minute now to scroll through a few people. Now, here's the thing. There's over 600 people. It's going to take a lot of podcasts to get to everybody. But Tim DeLapp, Jack Schaufler, Julian Wallinger, Jim Clark, Will Acko. I'm going to go on just a little bit longer. You can fast forward if you want, but I feel like people deserve the credit for participating in this. John Mew, Lewis McKenzie, North Bank Owlboy. That's his Twitter handle there if you want to follow him. Micah Hurt, Anonymous, one of my favorites, by the way. RG, the infamous RG, obviously. We'll go on, and again, we'll do more of this, and I had a list, and my list just crashed, so now I'm struggling. We're going to get to more people. The point is, like, everybody deserves to be thanked for this, and we will get to doing that. I just feel, like, really fortunate to be in a position where we can do something like that. Obviously, we gave our share, and thank you to so many of you who did as well, and this will run all month, so we can continue to do this, smash the goal, help the Arsenal Foundation, and do something positive at a time when a lot of us are doing that sort of stick gif thing of the guy poking at the thing on the ground saying, do something to Arsenal on the pitch, but we're doing something off the pitch, and that's important. Okay, a little bit of word salad there for me. Let's get Tim into the pod. You can find him on Twitter at Stobertohla. Tim.
Hello there.
Paul's on Twitter. Pause my pants. I'll pause.
Woohoo!
Stupid list. All you have to do is list stuff.
You could have just made stuff up. We'd be happy.
John Jameson. James Jefferson. James Jesterfeld. Lars Jesterton.
Whiskeys you drank last night, yeah.
That's the J's. Now we'll go to the G's. George Jurgensen. Okay, Tim, let's start with some actual football, because some actual football happened, and Arsenal beat Chelsea 3-2. And given that Arsenal did not beat Chelsea on the men's side, obviously I'm talking about women's football. A lot of splashes being made by Arsenal. Beating Chelsea, signing Tobin Heath, a big moment. You had the chance to interview, please help me with the pronunciation.
Jonas Eidevall.
Idabal. Thank you. Jonas Idabal, after the game, I had some advice for you, by the way, Tim. Name checked you directly in the answer about how to stay calm amidst tension. You can maybe get to that. But how big a start to the season is this for Arsenal? And maybe for people who don't follow the women's game, maybe there are some that will come into it now more with Tobin Heath joining, because obviously, like, a big, well-known player can always enlarge the tent. So what are the expectations for the season? How big was this in terms of a way to get off to a good start?
Yeah, sure. So in terms of getting off to a good start, Arsenal haven't beaten Chelsea for nearly 3 years, and they've only drawn one of those games. It's been the single biggest problem for them over the last couple of years, and it's one of the reasons that the previous manager left, because it's a problem he couldn't solve, losing to Chelsea. In the WSL, these games have a really outsized impact on where the title goes. And one of the reasons Arsenal haven't won anything for the last two seasons, because they haven't been winning these games, Arsenal beat everyone else under Joe Montemurro. That was the whole thing, was they beat everyone else, they beat them well. But if you want to win the league, or you want to win a cup, like if you want to win a cup, you've got to beat at least one of Man City or Chelsea. If you want to win the league, you can't lose both those games. You can maybe win one, lose one, win one, draw one, draw two. You can't lose both and win the league. Like, the league title is generally decided by these games. So, albeit it's the first game of the season, long way to go. In that respect, absolutely huge. Psychologically, absolutely huge as well. In front of a crowd of 9,000 at the Emirates as well. And it was just really nice, because just before the game, I was talking to someone and I said, I really wish we didn't have Chelsea first, because what Arsenal have done over the summer has really enthused people. And then, of course, you get the signing of Tobin Heath on deadline day, and you know, a bit like the Ozil signing, right? Everyone just goes, oh my God, I can't believe that we're signing this player. And you get all this excitement and you get all these extra eyeballs, and, you know, Arsenal add like another, you know, 5,000 Instagram followers and stuff like that. And then you think, but now we've got to play Chelsea, and that could be a real mood killer. I really don't want that. But happily, what happened was the absolute opposite. And Arsenal played really, really well, beat Chelsea well. They had a bit of an advantage in that they've played three Champions League qualifiers already this summer. And we'll see how that affects them down the line. But in terms of the first game of the season, they're ahead of Chelsea physically, and Chelsea left nearly all of their players out who played at the Olympics, whereas Arsenal had to bring them all back for Champions League qualifiers. So they're a little bit sharper than Chelsea at the moment, and it showed. But what was really exciting about it as well was Arsenal are going to move to a new brand of football. So under Joe, it was very possession-based, very patient, going backwards to go forwards, total football stuff. Jonas is, he's a big advocate of the high press, big fan of Bielsa, big fan of Jurgen Klopp. I don't want to say antics, but like, he's very excitable on the touchline in that Klopp kind of mold. He's constantly in the fourth official's ear. He's constantly kind of shouting at his players, both encouraging them, clapping them, berating them. Like, he's a bit of a whirlwind on the sideline. And he was asked about that post-match, and he came out with this quote. I can't quite remember it exactly, but he said something like, if you want your team to be on fire, you've got to show some heat, which was really, really nice. And it's just like, it's quite a change from Joe, who's Australian, Italian, like quite laid back and everything. So they've moved to this brand of high pressing football, and it might take them some time to fully acclimatize, but it was just really exhilarating watching Arsenal take it to Chelsea rather than take it from Chelsea, because that's how Chelsea play. They play a high press, and we've struggled with it. But Jonas came up with a way of playing around that. Also, you know, in his interview afterwards, he said in the last, because Arsenal went 3-1 up, then Chelsea got it back to 3-2 with 25 minutes to go, and they were under the cosh. And he just said afterwards, you know, that's fine. If you want to be a good team, sometimes you've got to defend for 20 minutes. And two players went off with cramp, and he said, that's fine. I like when my players go off with cramp. That means that they've put the shift in, and we'll put two other players on and we'll run their legs off as well. And you know, he talked about, sometimes you've just got to clear the ball. We like to play out from the back, but you know what? Sometimes the situation doesn't call for it. And so these things, they're just different. basically. That's, you know, it's very easy to fall into the trap of everything the previous manager did was rubbish and this new guy's brilliant. It's just different. And he said, yep, with 20 minutes to go, we defended the width of the box. We let them put crosses in. We smashed them clear. That's what we had to do to win the game. So that's what we did. And yeah, it was just really refreshing and just a great atmosphere, both tangibly and intangibly around the Emirates on Sunday.
Yeah, it's fantastic. We're going to get into Edu's interview, and that'll be the bulk of this episode. And we can maybe sort of contrast some of the things he said and the philosophy there with what is going on with the women in terms of their squad building. I'll stay with you just for one more second, though, Tim. One thing that I thought was interesting, you know, reading through his comments after the match, he was asked about switching Beth Mead and Iwabuchi in the second half. And he said, to be fair, it ended up like that after a set piece. We just decided to let them stay, so it's no credit to me. That's what is happening in football. It's more a player sport than something like the NFL. You need to let the players say when something is working, and the players need to be knowledgeable to solve those situations. Mm-hmm. Look, it's
hard
a layup for
a
leaning
contrast.
Into yeah, right? It's a layup for leaning into confirmation bias, and I'm going to do it anyway because what the hell? I mean, how do you feel the comparisons and contrast are between the women's coach and men's coach right now? And like a comment like that, do you feel that would be, I mean, this is so hard, right? Cause I'm leading the horse to water and I don't want to do that. I'm leading the witness a bit, but just maybe you can speak to that ideology and whether you see a little bit more freedom in the way that they were playing.
Yeah, definitely. It's weird really, because he's such an advocate of Bielsa, Klopp, and that's very like, you know, that's in that you've got to do that stuff together. So it is like tightly coached, but it does sound like he will look, because I asked him that question because Beth Mead swapped to the left wing and she scored twice in the second half. So I was kind of saying, what a great decision that was to swap her. And he just said, well, it wasn't my decision. Like it naturally went that way. And they were saying it was working. So I said, okay, that's fine. I trust my players. And he gave a fairly similar answer. There was a really nicely worked goal in not preseason, it was a Champions League qualifier. Really, really nice back to front move. And I think it was Art Deroche from The Athletic who asked him, like, you know, was that choreographed? And he said, it looked like it, didn't it? But no, he just said, they're really, really good players. And we've got really, really good attackers. And sometimes you've just got to let them play. You've got to let them riff a little bit. And that's exactly what they did. And one of the interesting things, you know, I asked him about the signing of Tobin Heath. Arsenal already have probably five wide forwards, if we're being generous, definitely four, two England internationals in her place. So I kind of asked him, you know, did you just sign Tobin Heath? Because it's Tobin Heath. And if you can get her, you do. And he said, in one respect, he said, yes. But in the other, he kind of said, because I want this press, he said, like, the wide forwards are the ones I want running the most. And he basically said, I'm going to have to rotate them game from game. And he basically said, not quite in as many words, it's pretty much impossible to do what I want you to do as a wide forward and play 90 minutes. Like, if you play as a wide forward for me, you're coming off with cramp after 70 minutes kind of thing. So he was like, I need that switch. So it looks like a contrast, to be honest, between there was some good choreographed stuff. There was some good stuff they worked on the training ground to avoid the press. But it does look like he will, particularly the forward players, let them riff a little.
Yeah. Interesting. Paul, you had a question?
Yeah, sparking off what you said. So like on the men's side, you tend to have the 18s, 23s, the men's team playing a similar style. But as you talk about, like, this was a great victory and everybody's excited, and maybe he leans a little towards the Klopp's, Bielsa's, this higher energy, higher intensity. Do you tend to see across the league similarities of style on both sides of the house, if you like, at clubs? Or like, because if the women are tearing it up with a Bielsa club style at Arsenal, and like the men's side is kind of down and gray, it's an uncomfortable contrast at times. It's kind of an interesting angle going forward that we've never had to worry about in a good way. But I'm just wondering, like, at the cities, at the Chelseas, do they tend to play a copacetic style across the whole club? Not, I mean, there's no reason to. You're not filtering the players into it. Just wondering culturally.
So City, definitely. They definitely do. And actually, the City manager, Gareth Taylor, he used to coach the under-21s at Man City. Mm. And they swap coaches. And like they swap within the City group as well, right? So the old coach of their women's team went to New York City. Like, it's a City group thing. So it's not just within the club. It's within all of their clubs. And they have Melbourne City and all of that. Chelsea are a very like high pressy type team. They play, in fact, they actually play quite a lot like, I'd say, the league winning Leicester side. Like, usually they're quite flexible, but usually they'll play like roughly a 4-4-2 and they play tap tap boom football. They don't mess up, like they don't pass the ball around the midfield. They get it forward quickly and early. And I guess I don't think the Chelsea men play like that. Where Chelsea men and women have a similarity is approaches to squad building. Chelsea women just buy stars. They don't give a fuck if they've got four players in that position. They bought Lauren James this summer from Manchester United. They've already got like six forwards and they're struggling to keep them all happy. They had a gaping hole at fullback, which Arsenal really exploited. They didn't buy a fullback. They bought another forward. Like, Chelsea women, same as Chelsea men, it's we're going to buy you all the talent and we're not going to bother whether the squad's balanced or not. You just get that talent on the pitch and doing things. So Arsenal, I'd say, is the only one where I think that is quite an astute point in terms of, because Joe was very Wenger, Arteta, you know, possession, total football, that kind of Cruyff kind of style. But so for Jonas to move to more of that, you're right, it could create quite an uncomfortable uncomfortable difference between the two teams, because it really looks like Arsenal are going to change style. I wouldn't say drastically, but there's going to be much more emphasis on that high press, and it's going to be gegenpressing. And in fact, Jonas Eidevall's on Twitter. His handle is @Eidevall. Just put in his handle and put the word press. And he used to be quite a frequent tweeter about coaching. And there's loads of interesting stuff there about how he does drills in training to coach the press. And he actually uses Paul. He puts up a clip with an example of a team scoring from counter-pressing. And he says, and his caption is, "Don't press to disrupt the opposition. Press to win the ball back and be a playmaker, not a destroyer." And that's kind of very much his style.
Cool. Very interesting. Well, let's move on a little bit. When we get into the Edu conversation, we can sort of contrast how the women are squad building in the Tobin Heath effect and talk about what Edu did.
Couldn't we stay talking about the women?
I mean, you're not wrong, but no, we're going to switch. Before we get to the Edu thing, just real quick, Paul, I think, you know, one of the things that a lot of us are looking forward to is the chance to see the team come back from this international break looking a little bit more like the team that's planned. And before we get into the Edu conversation, I'm just curious, like, what do you think is realistic to expect in terms of the integration of all these new players? I mean, I presume Ben White will be back. Sambi will almost certainly be starting. Tomiyasu, I mean, Edu was sort of on the fence about whether he would start or not, sort of said, you know, he can start right away, but it's up to Mikel Arteta. Odegaard certainly you'd think would start. I mean, it feels kind of crazy to say it, but we could have Ramsdale might even theoretically be in line to start, although I doubt it. But if it's Ramsdale, White, Tomiyasu, Sambi, Odegaard, five of the six summer signings could be in the team against Norwich or starting against Norwich. Is that possible, you think?
Yeah. It does seem like a season, though, in which your best laid plans, especially early on, will be laughed at, and like there'll just be stuff, people traveling back, COVID, blah blah blah. But yeah, it, like, based on what we know at the moment, we could be pretty close to that. On the other hand, he hasn't had that much chance to integrate these guys, play them together, etc. But yes, it's possible, and I think Norwich would be a very suitable game for us to try and play our football with these new players. So it's definitely a candidate.
And I mean, just for you, would you go that route? I mean, would you go the whole hog, or do you think it's just a case of like, too many new players that probably haven't had the full chance to be integrated together and work it in slowly. I mean, we're sort of in this very weird position now where there's not a lot of room for error for Mikel Arteta, right? I mean, this is a part of the fixture list where people will look at it and expect a lot of points to start being picked up. So I can see both sides that I need a little cohesion because I can't afford to have a sort of disorganized or uncoordinated performance against Norwich, and integrating too many players at once might do that. But by the same token, these are the players presumably he needed to be successful. I mean, there's a couple of them, like Sambi and Odegaard, that I don't think there's even a shadow of a doubt based on what's available. But, you know, and I guess White, given what we've got at center back, Tomiyasu and Ramsdale, I'm less sure about. Do you think that those are the two that maybe will be left out in this case?
And you got Gabriel coming back. I know we're talking about new signings, but it could look quite different. The challenge with, like, Tomiyasu in particular, for whatever reasons, maybe I'm overdoing the kind of change of league, change of language, change of culture kind of thing. His head could be spinning on, you know, where he gets his Nando's and where he gets his dry cleaning done, and just generally where, like, I don't know what he was doing over the international break, but he is a Japanese international. So I assume he's been, if I remember right, he's off on international duty and doesn't join the squad till after the interlull. I mean, I just think it's too much. Ramsdale, sure, why not? Depending on Arteta's approach to integrating Ramsdale, maybe we, like, my first thought against Chelsea was Leno had a bad game because it looked like he was afraid to play out from the back. Having watched it, I think that was strategy. So I don't know that Arteta has the, Leno might have done exactly what Arteta wanted him to do. I'm not sure. That's my read anyway in that particular game. So I don't know that he'll just go and swap him out. Unless I'm misreading that. So I think it's by person. I think they'll get a chance to acclimate. And the other tension with, on the one hand, we went to get these players because we needed them, but also you don't want to say to your existing players that the, you know, 5 minutes after Tomiyasu comes in the door, he starts, even though he doesn't know which way is up, tells the rest of your right back signings that you're desperate to not use them. So yeah, you gotta balance. So I don't think Tomiyasu would be my guess. Ramsdale, if he's got a kind of a, you know, maybe he has a bit of an excuse with Leno coming back, and he did start. I wonder if he'll start again because Neuer was out injured or something. Maybe there'll be a bit of COVID-y stuff, but I still think Leno's the starter right now. So I don't think I don't know that he's going to go nuclear day one with all these guys. He's going to integrate them. I think we might have to be a little patient.
Yeah. And I think, like, this is the problem with being in a firefighting position, right? I guess it's true the whole season. You have to pick up points, right? That's the goal. Yeah. But I think if you're coming from a position of more comfort, you can maybe do things that might be a little riskier, but right now he has to do whatever it takes that he thinks will get an immediate performance and immediate results. Let's shift gears to the Adu thing just a little bit. He looked great. He really did. You know, one button undone, freshly shaven. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if he is a Manscaped user. You know what? I bet he is a Manscaped user. And that gives me an opportunity to just make the point that you should be too. You know, before we talk about what Adu said, let's talk about how Adu prepared for that. You know, the way he grabbed his Lawnmower 4.0 is the way you can too. You want to be a director of football? This is where it starts. Having the right tools. Not the right tools on the pitch, the right tools in the bathroom to get yourself cleaned up, looking good, to sit in front of the Sky Sports cameras and explain why your club is a tire fire. So, Manscaped, well, what's it about? They've got the Lawnmower 4.0. It is single-handedly the greatest purpose-built product for shaving your body. It's that simple. And, you know, look, I wish they didn't call it Manscaped all the time because I know we have a lot of listeners who don't need to do Manscaping. They need to do womanscaping. And I want to be here for you to let you know that works too. You know, I'm not going to tell you about how much my wife loves it because I haven't asked her permission, but she loves it. So the fact of the matter is this is a great product. It has ceramic blades. It doesn't pull. It doesn't tug. It has a button lock. It has a light, extraordinary long life battery, wet dry shaver, and it has the contact charger now. The 4.0 does the, like, inductive charging where you just sit in a nice little cradle. It has different sizers, right? So you can do eyebrows or sideburns, you can get all over. And I think this is one of these points, right? Like when I first started doing this, I thought it was cringy. Now, I still think it's cringy, but at least I know the product's good. And I think that the point is like, this is something we all do, right? It's one of those things like most of us do some kind of grooming and most of us use a tool that you shouldn't, whether it's an old, you know, just like Bic razor in the shower that's been sitting there for ages. That just sounds like danger waiting to happen. Or a variety of different cheap things that we found on, you know, Amazon for £5 and it doesn't really do the job. Like this is the product you need. They have one for the nose as well called the Weed Whacker, nose and ears. Great products for your body as well. It's just a good company aligned with the Testicular Cancer Society. They work with them every summer. So like just a great organization to be involved with, a great product and one that you'll love. You can go to manscaped.com, use promo code ArsenalVision and save 20% off and get free worldwide shipping. 20% off and free worldwide shipping. I mean, that's a lot of savings. I hate paying shipping. So it's nice to have it free. And you can get it free wherever you are in the world. Lawnmower 4.0, Weed Whacker, all the products. Go to manscaped.com, promo code ArsenalVision, save 20% and free shipping. Tim, is that enough?
Yes.
I have to be honest, I wasn't ready to throw it in there, but I felt like we were shifting gears topic-wise, and I was thinking about how nicely put together Edu looked for his interviews, and it just got me thinking about the lawnmower, and so I thought, I'll stick it in there.
So is the light very useful on it?
It is, yeah. Yeah, very useful. I mean, like, I don't know what your bathroom lighting situation is, but unless you have, like, a ring light in your shower, yeah, like, it can be hard to see. And, like, you know, if you're doing your eyebrow stuff, like, you don't want to miss. You don't want to get the wrong size. You don't want to shave off an eyebrow because you didn't realize you don't have the you know, the right size.
How close are your eyebrows to your beaver?
I mean, well, it depends. You mean my pet beaver, Roger? Sometimes he sits on the vanity with me while I'm shaving my eyebrows.
This seems like a pretty wild sweep if you take off an eyebrow. Like you that's pretty bad coordination.
We love the sponsor and we're not going to malign the sponsor by degrading them in this way. But yes, Roger is sitting here with me right now. Aren't you, Roger? Good boy. Okay, Tim. Edu looked good. Mm. He talked the talk. He fronted up in front of the cameras. He deserves a little credit for that. But we're here to talk about substance more than style, quite clearly. And you know, there are a couple of things that I'd like to tease out of this. One of the things that he was really quick to talk about was building a foundation. Mm-hmm. And I talked with Scott and Paul about this on the Patreon episode, and I want to get your thoughts on this. We did quite clearly make a paradigm shift in our strategy this summer to get younger, to clear out older players, to bring in younger players. Everyone we bought under the age of 23, unless you want to count, you know, Shaka re-signing, but that's a slightly different situation. My question to you is whether this is the right way to build a foundation for where this squad is. I was looking at the ages of the players, and it's really interesting if you want to pull up a list like that, anyone, just pull up a list and look at our players. And like, there's a bunch of players you might rate, but they're over 30. There's a bunch of players you rate who are under 23. And it's like Party and Pepe in the middle. Literally, that's it. So how do you feel about the idea of 21 and 22-year-old players forming a foundation? Do you think that is the right way to do it, or did we need to be a little more varied in our approach? What's your take on his sort of explanation of the approach?
Yeah, sure. My take on it, so for a start, you know, just speaking personally, I didn't really feel like I needed this strategy explaining. I think it's really obvious to see.
You can't miss it when every signing's 22.
No, exactly. Although Gary Neville apparently missed it, so maybe that's why he felt the need to go and explain it. But so, I think that was really obvious that was what they were doing. So I didn't personally really need that explaining to me, but I get that I'm very engaged in the whole Arsenal thing, so I follow it very closely. My alter, like, yeah, good, get younger, fine. Like, yeah, don't sign Willian on a 3-year deal. I don't think you needed to do like a live, you know, you don't have to like stick your hand in the toaster to understand that sticking your hand in the toaster is a bad idea, but you know, we stuck our hand in the toaster a couple of times. For me, it's all kind of moot, Elliot. The only thing that matters is whether they're any good. If they're good and young, great. Like, that's absolutely great. Obviously, that's better than being good and old or crap and old. But the only thing that really matters is the talent level. Now, I kind of agree with what Paul said on the Patreon pod in terms of there are tiers of signing here. So like Ben White, Martin Odegaard, they're coming straight into the spine of our team and they're coming in to lift certain departments straight away, which is fine. Ramsdale, will probably be able to say that in a couple of months. He will take Leno's place, I am sure, at some point this season. Just depends when it is. So you could kind of lump those three together. But then Lokonga the right back.
Nuno.
Tomiyasu.
Mm-hmm. Tomiyasu, that's it, sorry. And Tomiyasu, those are, I think, are slightly more punts, I guess. Tavares, I'll be honest with you, Tavares I don't really care about, and that sounds really brutal, but like when you sign a left back the same summer that you give your first choice left back a 5-year, like I feel like about the backup left back that you would feel about a backup goalkeeper, Elliot, in terms of the range of outcomes with Tavares is really, like, there are three things that can happen, right? He's either crap and fine, we probably get rid of it. We probably sell him back to Portugal easily enough in 2 years. He's good, but not good enough to take over from Tierney, in which case he goes anyway because he's not playing. Or the third outcome is that he's brilliant and he takes Tierney's place. I think that's really unlikely. So essentially, he's either crap or he's okay. And that's fine, right? I don't think we could have aspired to have done much more in that position. But like the only thing that matters, like however young or old they are, is whether they're any good. And again, on the Patreon pod, you know, Paul was talking about the usually in this situation, one third are good, one third are okay, and one third are not. Like, if only we had like an example in the last 15 years of Arsenal signing lots of young players, and what happened then? Yeah, they fell into three tiers, didn't they? Like you had your superstars like Fabregas, Van Persie. You could make an argument for Walcott going into that tier based on his output. And then you had that kind of middle tier. And then, like, you know, maybe Diaby, Danielson, Song, players like that, maybe even Giroud, Senderos, depending on. And then there was like the layer that just didn't make it, like Carlos Vela, for example. So, like, that's the thing with young talent, is quite often it ends up going a bit wayward for any number of reasons, injury, attitude, not settling, blah, 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 whatever. So ultimately, like, however, like getting younger, yeah, good. But like, if we finish 10th, no one's going to say, well, at least we're nice and young. The only thing that really matters is if they're any good. And that is what this project will live and die by. And that is what will determine whether Edu and Arteta keep their jobs. That's it. Nothing else.
Yeah. And so I want to get to the question of sort of talent and range of outcomes. This is the interesting thing for me, Paul, with this strategy. Everybody sort of knows reductively that you want to get younger. You don't want, you know, these aging players on your books that you can't move, that we needed to get younger, that we had a challenge with the squad. And I agree with that. But I think there's a reason you want a distribution of ages because of the range of outcomes theory, right? Which is, but it's not just about age, it's about talent. And maybe this is what I'm trying to tease out of this situation. If you buy an elite talent, then they can still bomb. I think of some of the purchases Chelsea made down the years, Shevchenko, Torres. But by and large, when you buy elite talent, the range of outcomes is relatively small. They might just be okay, they might be extraordinary, but it's a pretty narrow band. So if you buy a Kylian Mbappe, you mostly know what you're going to get. When you dip down into like the 15 million, 10 million, 22-year-old range, you are getting a player with a wide range of outcomes. On the, you know, and if you express it as sort of like a violin chart, right? The long tail of it is they become super elite. You know, they become like a world beater. The long tail on the other end is they just become a total dud, a complete bust. And the fat tail in the middle is sort of like, or the hump in the middle is sort of like, they're fine. They're a fine player. I wonder if it's not so much that we didn't get the right age profiles and get decent players this summer, but did we add the elite talent? You know, there was a video going around of Cesc Fabregas on Twitter the other day, and I'll always watch those videos if you want to send them to me. You know, and he's assisting Robin Van Persie, and I'm thinking, you know, there was always some degree of elite talent at Arsenal. Alexis and Ozil in their prime, Van Persie and Cesc Fabregas, right? You had these players. Obviously, the Invincibles were just a, you know, 9 or 10 of those caliber players, and some even beyond that. But I do wonder if the issue I have this summer, as I really look at it, isn't that the strategy was wrong necessarily, but that we have a wide range of outcomes with most of the players we've gotten, and I'm not sure about the elite talent. Like, if you look at our squad right now, Paul, most of the players you'd say, oh, that guy's elite, are projecting on young players. Odegaard, Smith Rowe, Martinelli, Saka, right? The other guys you might say are elite, like Aubameyang, I think we'd agree has aged out of the really elite category. So is it possible to like the approach we've taken, the strategy we've taken, but be concerned that we have not added the elite talent, that on a pure talent basis, what we've done is sort of committed to a more middling squad, albeit a younger squad that has room to improve?
Yeah. I'm thinking about through this one on my feet. So to buy elite talent this year, you couldn't buy six players.
No. Let me just make that point. Sorry to interrupt, but just so I don't sound like an idiot. I'm not saying we should have bought six elite players. I'm saying when you are one of the biggest spending clubs in Europe, could the approach have been to add more elite talent instead of numerically adding a lot of talent, but maybe more talent with wider ranges of outcomes in terms of whether they'll be elite?
Yeah, I guess my point is we actually needed numbers. I mean, they're trying to do several things. There's a whole talent discussion. There's the reset on the wage structure in the club, which this isn't just about young, a project building for the future. To me, this is the Kroenke saying, that's enough of this bullshit, buying nearly elite players, but for super elite wages, because we're out of the Champions League. So we want a Champions League level player. We've got to pay way over the odds. The ball's all in their court. The contract is all around their terms and conditions. And 3 years later, because they got frustrated with Arsenal and the way we're going, we have a player who's not quite performing where he needs to be. We would really like to move him on, but we can't. So in a sense, I don't know that the days where Arsenal could buy three elite players and not pay way over the odds in a market, like they may be looking at the market and saying, this isn't where it stops. Like players are all going to run down their contracts. We're seeing that. We can't be buying players. Like if you buy an elite player now, he's not buying versus future post-COVID readjusted wage structure, taking everything into account. He's still thinking what he got paid last year and the year before. Why wouldn't he? He's getting paid it right now because they're all on those contracts. So I think if just from a securing your future model standpoint, this isn't all about football. This isn't all about a footballing project. This is about blowing up the wage structure, hitting the restart button, brooming out all the bums. No offense meant. I love a number of them. But brooming them out, paying them off, like they're still like, can you imagine having to pay off effectively 3, 4, 5 players on big wages and just saying, here's all your wages, go away. Go away 6 months early, go away a year early. Like I suspect the Kroenkes had two options for Edu and Arteta. One was, you can have this tiny war chest to do that shit we've been doing for years, or you can have this really big war chest, but you hit the blow up button, reset the wages, go 21 to 23 for players who will take way less wages and adjust to a bigger club. Like it's a win-win. The gamble is, will they be good enough? How many of them will be good enough? Will they be good soon enough? Even if they're good, are they a fit? Will the guy we need, like if you need, let me pick an example. If you need White, for example, to step up immediately because that's a starter you bought, it's no good that he's not the guy that didn't work out, but say Nuno's brilliant, right? You need if you're going to have a third great and a third who don't quite pan out, they better be in the right spots. You need White to be one of the ones that was great, and Nuno, if you have to pick two, who are not great, to be one of the ones who isn't great. So there's a lot of gamble here, but I think gravity, the force of gravity in this situation is the Kroenke saying, yeah, well, we're not doing it. We're not buying you three elite players. We've done that. The world is changing. We're not going to be on the wrong side of it. And I do think we needed the numbers. So we had to go for volume. The only way this all worked was young, talented, low wages. We'll pay a little too much on a couple of the fees, but we got to hit the reset button. Let's do a project.
Yeah. And I understand, like, Tim, a lot of people are going to say the issue is because of where Arsenal are currently, there's only certain players we can attract. Now, I sort of agree and I sort of disagree. You see elite players wind up at clubs in worse situations than ours. And Liverpool, after their eighth place season, right after Klopp arrived, I think their two big signings that summer were Sadio Mane and Gini Wijnaldum, I believe. It was the summer after. No, it was that summer. And obviously, they got it right with both. But in Sadio Mane, they got an elite player to come to them just entering his prime and really make a big difference. Now, you could argue we tried to do something similar with like a Nicola Pepe, paid way over the odds, and didn't get that elite kind of player that Liverpool did with like Sadio Mane. And then subsequently, they parlayed going into the top four to get players like Van Dijk and Mohamed Salah. But I kind of want to poke at the same question with you, which is, on the surface, I like this strategy, and I think you can make an argument for a lot of the players. I mean, Ben White, would I have gone as big on Ben White? We needed a center back. I think that much becomes clear. And while I think the Saliba situation has been handled poorly, even if he was in the team, you could argue we still need a center back. We needed a right back. We needed a midfielder. We needed an attacking midfielder. We bought all of those positions, and I'd say that we did it competently, and yet outside of maybe Martin Odegaard, who I think you could say has at least potentially that elite kind of talent in him, whether you agree or disagree, your mileage may vary. Do you think that we, with the amount of spending we made, added those kind of tentpole elite talented players in the squad that you say, this immediately changes your fortunes? Like when Alexis came into our squad, he was a force of nature. It immediately transformed us in some respects. Ozil had a similar impact early in his career. And I just wonder if maybe I look at the squad now and I think we acquired a lot of the things we needed within a band of talent that's acceptable without getting that player who's going to be sort of jet fuel in our engine, you know?
Yeah, I think the bet they've taken is that, maybe Ben White and Odegaard are the Mane and Wijnaldum of this project. Wijnaldum had not much of a reputation when he went to Liverpool. Newcastle went down and there weren't that many clubs after him at all. Mane, slightly different, I think. I think people saw potential there, but not this sort of potential. I remember thinking, yeah, I'd quite like him at Arsenal. But I don't remember thinking, oh, like this guy will absolutely kill it. I just thought, yeah, he looks a good player.
Feels a lot like the Diogo Jota signing to me, where you kind of knew there was someone in there, but they saw something a little more than that.
Yeah, exactly. And so what the question is whether we've been right with that evaluation. So we've overpaid for Ben White. I think pretty much everyone accepts that. But have we? Like, we might have overpaid in 2021, but the gamble is, or the bet rather, is in 2023. We look back and then think, nope, we didn't. Well, maybe we overpaid at the time, but nope, that's okay. Because I remember thinking that Mane, I think Liverpool got him for 30 million. And I remember thinking, 30 million, that's like, he really needs to be good for that kind of money. And he was, so it was fine. But I remember thinking, yeah, I'd like Mane at Arsenal, and then seeing the price and thinking, well, yeah, I'd probably go for that. But I wasn't like absolutely, yeah, you must get this player. And so that's the gamble. That's the kind of what they've bet on this summer is that they've identified talent early, at least in like that. I don't think that so much with like Lokonga, I think is more of a long range bet, as it were. That's a kind of, okay, he can be a backup now, and if we're lucky, but if we're good, he can be even more than that in a couple of years. But if he never, if he's just better than Elneny, that's kind of fine. So ultimately the question is, have they correctly identified the ceiling and the potential of these players? And that's what everything hinges on here.
Yeah. And I mean, there's only one way we're going to find that out, right? Like, they're going to look like geniuses when this becomes the core of a future world-beating team, where they're going to look like they locked us into a mid-table future by buying mid-table talent. And I'm sure people have strong opinions about which way that's going to go. but it's going to go how it's going to go, and we can't do anything about it but watch. So, I mean, this is the problem with debating player identification. You know, everybody has an opinion about talent. I just think when you buy in certain bands of elite talent, you really do narrow the outcome, the range of outcomes. I think where I'm at with this is I kind of like the project. I'm kind of curious and interested in the players they bought. I think they bought players with wide ranges of outcomes. Like, Tim, if I told you Ben White just fails as a center back, it doesn't work for him, I don't think you'd say that's crazy. You can't picture it. But likewise, if I said he became sort of the tenacious, ball-winning, ball-playing superstar center back that changes our buildup, you could see that too. It just feels like with a lot of these players that that range of outcome is there. Maybe Odegaard least of all, because I see a player who is what he is. Like, he's going to be a tempo quickener, a connector, a creative player who hopefully adds even a little more end product with assists and goals, but is always going to have that technical quality. I'll stay with you for 1 second to this point, though. In terms of talking about the project, the one thing that came through, I think, both in Ornstein's reporting on the Arscast and beyond, and then with listening to Adu here, is maybe we misread the room in terms of Adu's role. Do you get a sense now that he's fronted up, he's talked about the project, he's talked about his role in it, and we've gotten some of the reporting around this, that it's pretty clear now that Adu is not some, he's not Reek. You know, he's not sitting there just being told what to do, but that he is an active participant, in large part leading the project, and that maybe we need to revise our understanding of his relationship with Arteta, where he really is the boss, and this really is his project to run. I mean, I don't think I would have said that a few weeks ago, but I feel pretty strongly that's the case now.
Yeah, and just a warning, you're going to get some background noise.
Well, that is life with a baby.
Yeah. You didn't take the hint when I went on mute.
Sorry, would you like me to throw that to Paul? How dire is the situation?
No, it's absolutely fine. So I never sensed a diminishment in status for Edu. I think Paul's got this one right, in that I think this is the Kroenke's call kind of thing. I think this is like, look, we bought you Pepe, we bought you Partey, you wanted those players, like prime age players we spent loads of money on. We can't do that again. We need you to show you're working a bit more now, because I do suspect that if you'd have offered Arteta another load of 28, 29 year olds this summer, that's exactly what he would have wanted, because that's, you know, I guess more likely to keep him his job in the short term. But you know, and that's what a technical director is there to do. And a technical director is there to say, well, your short term is not as important as our long to medium term. So I guess when you say Edu's driving this, I reckon that's probably on behalf of Josh Kroenke. Like, I've got a feeling that, I mean, it would be absolutely amazing if they aren't looking at this squad and thinking, what the hell have you been doing with all our money all these years? It's incredibly frustrating they haven't asked those questions a lot earlier. And quite frankly, I think the Kroenkes strike me as quite easy to grift.
Because they don't know.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, if you were a grifter, like, Arsenal would be a fantastic club to go to, quite frankly. But
I mean, to be fair, we are a club that gave a sponsorship to a fake car company. So.
Well, yeah. So I imagine that, like, there's been a conversation between Edu and Josh Kroenke, and it's probably gone something along the lines of, what we were doing didn't work, do something different.
Yeah. Yeah. And they have done that. So, Paul, I will go to you now so that, to be fair, I was going to say you have a hysterical baby in the background, but usually you have a hysterical baby in the foreground hosting the podcast. So it's sort of continuity, I guess, in that respect. Paul, this hierarchy now seems clear, but I think they're inextricably linked, because I think one way or the other, if this project, quote unquote, fails, I don't see it sparing Adu and the hammer falling on Arteta. So there's definitely a synergy here. One of the things that I thought was interesting in this, though, and I'll try to find the quote, it's really the way he talked about the decision of where the money needed to be spent. You know what? I'll paraphrase it rather than searching for the quote. He basically said that, you know, Mikel Arteta and I decided that defense was where the big spending was needed, that in midfield we had, you know, reliable players we could trust in Partey and Granit Xhaka, and we felt comfortable with that, so we didn't need to add one. You know, we added Sambi for the future, but we were happy with what we had in midfield. And I think where a lot of people would maybe express their frustration with this project isn't the getting younger, isn't even some of the players we brought in. It was the prioritizing. So do you think, like, to some extent, as crazy as it sounds, the success or failure of this project is going to hinge in some respects on whether they got the priority right, right? Leaving midfield alone, more or less, you know, I know Sambi is one for the future, is how they see it, and one for the present, given the red card situation. But, and they saw central defense as the place that the most important spending needed to be made. Do you think that's really what it boils down to? Not so much the players they targeted or the strategy of getting younger, but whether they had their priorities right in terms of just positional need?
I think there's a, like, if I look at frustration, most of this frustration is around our midfield. But like in the decision tree, that one comes really early on. Arteta likes Xhaka. Is Xhaka staying or going? It turns out he's staying because I don't suspect there was the willingness from the Kroenkes to fund a 50 million or 40 million or 45 million midfielder that we would need to replace him if we were only getting buttons for Xhaka. And so I could be wrong on that, but I think there is a limit to what the Kroenkes were willing to do. Xhaka would have had to go, and when you read the comments of the general manager from Roma, midfield turned out to be low in their priorities, and that's why they didn't push the boat out or even get the boat in the water or even dust off the boat and take off the tarpaulin. They didn't really go for it. If we'd made it cheap enough, they might have. So we were basically stuck with Xhaka or basically nearly give him away. And that was not an acceptable approach within Arsenal. And Arteta likes Xhaka. He'll live and die by that decision. But he clearly decided early on that White was his priority in terms of, you know, the first area we look to seriously address and spend a lot of money on, spend too much money on, you could say, and that's fine in one position. Go and get the guy you want for the position you need to fill first was White, and you would say Odegaard because they knew that was going to take a little longer. Those were the two priority positions. I don't know that we could have made three priority positions. So in a sense, Arteta made a calculation that he was happy with Xhaka. He couldn't have replaced David Luiz with a David Luiz analog. Of course, White and Luiz can be quite different, but you can see why he thought that was the analog for Luiz. That gives me the thing that I build from the back on. I need that guy. You can see why he absolutely committed to Odegaard. If you commit to three players you absolutely have to have that you're going to spend shitloads of money on, you've just gone to the model where you're buying three elite players regardless of cost. I don't think it was feasible to replace the midfield given the circumstances. I like Xhaka, I rate him, all that kind of stuff, but we were all ready for a redo or a refresh, a clean sheet of paper in midfield, do something different. What was the original question? I know I'm talking around it.
Because look, all this stuff it's tough because we've talked through it so much all summer. Yeah. So trying to get it at it from a different angle now, like I'm ready for the football. But like, it's the question of whether this all hinges on whether they targeted the right positions, right? Like, some people would have said striker and central midfield might have been the priority. They went with attacking midfield, center back and keeper, right? And then, you know, a couple odds and ends here and there.
I can't imagine how you don't need Odegaard or somebody like him. I love Smith Rowe, but I actually think Smith Rowe and Odegaard should swap numbers on their shirts because they've got it wrong. They don't do the same things at all. Odegaard is a very different player, a player we need for Arteta or for most other managers. He's a true 10. Smith Rowe is kind of an attacking 8-10. If you had two 10s, like, say, Chelsea use or City use, Smith Rowe and Odegaard, maybe. I just don't see that we didn't need an Odegaard. I think that's transparent. I don't see how we didn't need to replace not just a centre back, but David Luiz's presence in the back line. Did we get it right with White? I can't see how I'd call that wrong. Other people might have done it differently, but that seems totally reasonable for Arteta to have prioritized there, given that Partey, Xhaka were pretty good for the most part last season. I don't think that's my priority. They're already here. How do you replace them? So, and when I look around the team, our starting 11 at each position, like it's still only right back I have a question mark. Everywhere else, I can find a really good name I like if I can get over Partey, Xhaka in midfield, which I can, with a really good backup, Sambi, who, like, if I, and then to the elite thing in terms of signings, I could
That's really it for me, yeah.
Yeah. In terms of elite signings, I can see Odegaard, White, and Sambi being plausibly some close to the elite level. That could pan out for me. It's not a complete shot in the dark that those three, based on what I've seen, might turn out to be three elite guys.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink, which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
It's tricky, right? Because development is not linear. So, like, you can't ask players to be the same quality at the same age as other players. Like, when I look at the ages of players like Trent Alexander-Arnold and Kai Havertz, right? And, I mean, Mbappe and Haaland, obviously, but, you know, you don't have to go up to that tier. Like, Kai Havertz is a pretty damn good player. He's younger than Mason Mount, which I did not realize. Like, it does make you sort of wonder, have we sort of overrated some of the young talent we have? But again, that talent can develop at different stages at different ages. We've set our course now really clearly. And I think this will wind up being one of the most important transfer windows in recent club history because we bought a lot of players. And the range of outcomes for those players, I think, is fairly wide. And if they're able to hit higher end outcomes, we will be a very difficult club to beat with the amount of high end young talent in our team. If they hit sort of mid-range outcomes, we may have locked ourselves in, so to speak, to a more mid-table existence by committing to players who don't have that elite ceiling. But that's what we'll find out over the next few seasons. Tim, just real quick to finish off on this sort of squad building thing. Adu told us this is the foundation. This is the course we set. He explained it clearly. I think he deserves credit for that. But, you know, talking about the project isn't what you paid the big money for. It's getting it right. And time will tell if he did. The women are undergoing a bit of a different project. And obviously adding someone like Tobin Heath, you know, when you talk about that elite talent, there is no getting away from Tobin Heath as elite talent, a world-renowned player in the women's game. She's also 33. So you know where I would come down on Arsenal adding a 33-year-old, but it's obviously a very different game. How would you contrast the squad building going on the women's side in terms of their philosophy of building a winner?
Yeah, very different. And actually, Arsenal women tried to do a bit of a youth, not a youth project, that's overstating it, but they signed some young players. So they signed a 20-year-old Swiss midfielder last summer, a couple of 21-year-old centre-backs, and they had a 23-year-old kind of number 10 who they started playing every week because they kind of said she's the future. Two of those players have gone, and so's the manager, which kind of tells you how that went, really. And in the women's game, I don't think it's possible to do this kind of project because the contracts are shorter. The contracts are only, I mean, they're usually about 2 years. They're kind of pushing up to three. The elite players might get four, but not much more than that. So the turnover's so big that you can't really do that kind of youth project. And I think Arsenal have realised that. And I think Arsenal have also realised who they're competing with in Chelsea, and they've just been more aggressive. Now, we should say, like, the women's squad is in a much better place. Its age profile, it was like Joe Montemurro actually left it in terms of age profile, really, really good. There's like a couple of players over 30, but most players are like between 23 and 27. So the age profile is really, really good. But yeah, like the way to be successful in women's football tomorrow is to be successful today. Like there's so much turnover that you can't really build for the future. But the other key thing that's in play is basically transfer fees aren't a thing. And when they, like, the world record transfer was Pernille Harder to Chelsea. That's £350,000. Like, transfer fees basically don't exist. And when they do, for clubs like Arsenal and Chelsea and Man City, they are actual pennies. So So yeah, like Tobin Heath, 33. I think she's on a 1+1 contract. We got her for free. We'll lose her for free. So it goes. That's pretty much how it goes with every player you get. You're not really looking at making money back. So actually, probably an even better example, because Tobin Heath, she's 33. Like I said to you off mic, Elliot, I'd compare that to United signing Ronaldo. It's like she's probably about to hit the age curve, but that's relative to her own talent. She will still do very well. We have lots of players in her position as well. We don't have to play her every single week. I think the more interesting signing this summer for Arsenal women like that is Nikita Paris. So Nikita Paris used to play for Man City. She went to Lyon for 2 years. She's come to Arsenal, big experience, scored loads and loads of goals in the WSL. She will definitely score double figures this year, bearing in mind the WSL has 22 games. She's 27. So like in the men's game, that would be like party, right? You'd be like, okay, we've got a forward who guarantees you goals. I know Partey's not a forward, but bear with me. Like we've got like a player who, like the range of outcomes are small in Nikita Paris. She will score goals. She will make goals because that's what she's always done. In the men's game, you'd have to think, oh yeah, but if we sign them on a 4-year deal, then they're 31. And then what do we do? Doesn't matter in the women's game because there's no transfer fees. So if she's signed for 2 or 3 years, and that's all Arsenal women get from her, like, fine. That's just what happens anyway. And I think Arsenal have realised that, like, that the whole, like, building for the future idea, it just doesn't happen like that in the women's game. And Arsenal in the WSL, they're one of, like, the big three. So they haven't, like, lost their status. They won the league title in 2019. You know, they're still one of the big players in there. And what they've done this summer is said, let's make sure we stay one of the big players, and let's not even make sure that we're still on like what we did on the men's side, where it's like, well, if we're in the top four and we're in the big four and now we're in the big six and all of that, it's like, no, let's play to win the league and try and win the Champions League. And the other thing about the short contracts is on the women's side, Leah Williamson, Jordan Nobbs, Vivian Miedema, all these players have 1 year left on their contracts, and they're all going to be thinking about what their next move is. They don't want to babysit a youth project. They want to win now. Like, you don't keep Vivian Miedema by saying we've signed a couple of 22-year-olds who will be good in a couple of years. You know, whether we keep Miedema or not, I'm not sure ultimately, but you certainly go a longer way to convincing her with Tobin Heath than you do by buying youth. That simple.
You've just struck a chord with me that I think resonates in the men's game too, which is like, I don't think the age curve thing shouldn't be a hard, fast rule. If you can get a player of, let's say, Cristiano Ronaldo's caliber and economically it works for you, you always do it. Where I think you run into a problem is when you've got players like Aubameyang on huge money who are at the tail end of that curve and they're not there to be the cherry on top to win a title. They're there with a bunch of 22-year-olds trying to get to sixth. I think it's much harder to get a player on huge money at the end of his career to really have the burning desire to go chase sixth place on the progression back to being top four to someday hopefully go get a title versus getting that same. I mean, if Aubameyang had gone to Manchester City, I have no doubt he scores 25 goals and helps them win a title. You know what I mean? Because that's a project that at that stage in your career, you can be energized from. And if you're going to say, well, he's a professional, it shouldn't matter. I agree. But look at the quotes from Willian that have just come out.
Yeah.
Basically, he's like, it wasn't right there. You know, I was there for one type of project. That wasn't the type of project, and I wasn't happy. And not a lot of people, Tim, are going to be sympathetic of a guy who's supposed to make £250,000 a week saying I wasn't happy, it wasn't the right project for me. I get it. I have no sympathy for that either. Screw that. Go play your heart out. But that is the reality with footballers. And so I think maybe one of the confrontations we have here is, you know, you add Tobin Heath to a very, very good Arsenal to go chase a title. That's one thing. You have players like Willian and Aubameyang there to shepherd 22-year-olds back to sixth place. It's a lot harder to get the most out of them, isn't it?
Yep, 100%, 100%. And like, and for a player like Tobin Heath as well, she'll look at Arsenal and she'll say, well, yeah, and you know, she played for Manchester United last season, so she's played against Arsenal. She knows what they're about. She knows what the league's about. And she'll look at them and go, yeah, they can win the league. And I can help them do that, and they will challenge for the league like that. That it's not a difficult sell as a quote unquote project. It is Arsenal, like Arsenal women, is a much, don't compare them to Arsenal men. If you're looking for an analogy in the men's game, look at Manchester United. That's kind of what Arsenal women are in the women's game. They're like the most successful club. They're always challenging for trophies, even when they're not very good. By their own standards, they'll get to cup finals and stuff. Like, they compete for trophies every year without fail. So that's kind of, even in Arsenal women's like bad years, they'll probably get to a cup final or something. And that's and you know, and they've had that brand of success for quite a long time. So a player like Tobin Heath, she's an Arsenal fan, by the way, massive Arsenal fan. And a lot of that, like in the women's game as well, like people who maybe even don't even watch English women's football, like you go abroad or whatever, they'll be like, oh yeah, Arsenal, like we know Arsenal, like they, when I was a kid, they were winning the league every year. That's what it's like. It's much closer to Manchester United. And that's why a club like Manchester United, even though they've not been relative to their own resources in the best shape over the last couple of years, players don't turn them down. Generally speaking, if they get the chance to go there, they go there because of the name. And Arsenal women have a similar pull. They just needed, I think, to pull their finger out and really realize what's happening in the women's game. And with the broadcast money coming in from Sky and stuff like that, I think they realized, like, right, there's a boom happening here, and we're already near the top. Like, we did the groundwork arguably decades ago that a lot of these other clubs like West Ham, Tottenham, they're all trying to scrabble in, you know, to the middle tier of that league. Whereas Arsenal are like, we did that ages and ages ago. We're at the top of this league, and we can stay there with, by the standards of the entire club, a relatively moderate investment.
Yeah. And if you can do that, you do it. And I think, look, for me, we can really go over the deep end of squad building and age curves and value, and all of those things matter in terms of how you build a winner when you're on, you know, a budget that's not Manchester City's. But it is a fancy way of distilling the most basic point. It is all about talent. It is all about talent. Forget the coach, forget the squad building. If you have enough talent, your team will win. Teams that are poorly coached will win. Now, when you have a good coach and great talent, you can dominate. You can do extraordinary things. Klopp deserves a lot of credit for what he's done at Liverpool, but I think Liverpool's talent level is woefully misunderstood in terms of just how many extraordinarily elite players they have at critical positions. Manchester City, great coach, absolutely extraordinary talent. And yes, can talent give up on a coach and fail? Yes. But overall, it is all about talent. And for Arsenal, it is all about talent too now, because we've committed to young players. Are they elite talent? Will they get us where we want to go? We have really committed to this. So we need to get those ceiling outcomes. Let's finish with just a quick look ahead. Because, Paul, I knew things were bad, and I don't want to over-index Twitter sentiment as an indication of what the fan base is feeling. But I wrote like a 2-tweet thread. It wasn't even like optimistic particularly. It was just like, I'm really excited to watch us play Norwich. I'm really excited to see us with all our players, because now we can start to draw some real conclusions, because these next few games are winnable and we should have our players back. That was basically all I said. It wasn't like, oh, we're going to be amazing. It was nothing like, and people were furious with me. The other games don't count? What? Oh, so we just get to pass for getting humiliated? Oh, I guess Brentford didn't count. Oh, like, I didn't say any of that. But people are furious. They are not willing to see the caveats about why we lost to Brentford, Chelsea, and City. They are not willing to look at the excuses about players being unavailable. They're not willing to look at the excuses of the caliber of the opposition. People are upset. They're really upset. And I'm not here to tell them they shouldn't be. But I am here to say that I think that translates into a run of games that are very, very important for Mikel Arteta's future. It's 6 games in the league with Wimbledon mixed in. And those 6 games are against 3 to 4 relegation strugglers. And 4 of the games are at home. Norwich, Burnley, Tottenham, Brighton, Palace, Villa. Okay? 4 of those games are at home, 2 are away. Away to Burnley, away to Brighton, the rest are home. I'm not saying you got to get max points there, but we will be favorites in every one of those games, is my presumption, other than maybe Spurs at home, and that one it'll be close. What does Arteta have to achieve over that run? Or does it not matter in your view? I mean, is it a case where it really doesn't matter? There's no outcomes that would be unacceptable for him. But I think, even just setting aside whether he gets sacked or not, What do we need to do in that run of games to get this back from being a situation where you can't even write, I'm looking forward to watching Arsenal, without people jumping down your throat about it?
Like, people always want you to put a number. I know you're not asking me this, but people always want you to put a number, or like, when will you be done with Arteta and stuff? And like, it's messy. It's fuzzy logic. It's like pornography, according to the Supreme Court.
You know it when you see it?
You'll know it when you see it, or you won't know it until you see it. Look, we should beat Norwich. We then play Burnley. We had a hard time against Burnley last year. They seem, given our Brentford experience, they seem well set up to exploit any exposure we might have to aerial weaknesses in our back line. Gulp. So that could be a challenging little duel. Spurs seem to be in a good run of form. So there's your first three games. Brighton are playing good football. The XG Kings, they're at home versus us. Then we play Crystal Palace at home, so we should twat them.
I'll be there, so we better.
Yeah, good, good. Then we play Aston Villa at home, who may have found their strut and their stride then, but we should still play good football and probably win there. I don't know how you say what it is you expect from those games. I'm going to stay calm. I'm going to look to see progress. I'm going to look to see, is it starting to make sense? I don't expect my brethren in the Twitter community or in the Arsenal community to be as calm as I am while we're going through this. I expect to have a couple of my own meltdowns when I don't see things happening. We're in a tough place, and Arteta has to play his way out of this and needs to get this team to start playing his football, good football, getting results or looking damned unlucky when he doesn't, and play us forward and build. But the problem is progress isn't linear. We'll have some setbacks. It's, again, not entirely sure if I'm addressing the question or even what the question was. I think it's going to be messy, and I think we'll have to say to ourselves, I'm giving it 10 games, and even though after six games I want this to stop, I'm going to give it the 10 games I wanted to give it and see where it's at and see is there progress and be honest with it and see if there's if it's a random walk but in an upwards direction or a random walk and we're going down.
I would say this. Well, so Tim, one of the things, and we'll finish here. I think I was under the impression before all this Edu stuff broke over the last couple of weeks in terms of what he's been involved in and his role at the club and then the interview, that it was sort of like the only person that could really sack Arteta was the Kroenkes, and they're not too plugged in, so he has a long leash. Now I get the sense that Edu really feels very much the boss here, that Edu is very connected to this project. He's put his face on TV as the face of this project, and I don't think he'll want to be embarrassed about it. I think he would sack Arteta to save his job. So what I guess I would say to him is I do think that this run has a number, that if he doesn't hit that number, he's gone. Mm-hmm. I think it's six games in the league plus the Wimbledon game, which not super important and almost certainly would be fine. But four at home, I think he's got to take around 12 points from these six games, which is a big hurdle to get over to save his job. I just think, and it's not just the points. There have to be goals. There has to be good attacking football. It has to look coherent. The new signings have to impress. I think the bar is actually quite high for him now. I think the unfortunate thing about the way the season started is he doesn't just have to be okay now because he had an okay start. He had the worst possible start you could have with all caveats in place, and he now has to have a better than expected recovery from that just to balance it back out to neutral. So I'm going to put it around 12. I think he's got to win four of these six games. I think you have to beat Palace at home. I think you have to beat Norwich at home. I think you almost kind of have to win the North London Derby or at least play well in it in getting something and then pick another game, Villa at home. I think you got to win those games.
But it's like a decade since we've averaged 2 points a game.
I literally said it's a very high bar. I think if he doesn't win four games, he's gone. What do you think, Tim?
I'm not sure it's that paradox of the heap thing again, isn't it? Where it's like how many individual grains of sand constitute a heap and you can't put a number on it, but
The heap amount, yeah.
You know when you see it, you know.
A stack of pornography magazines.
That's
a heap of them.
A heap of porn.
Yeah, yeah. When does it go from like a stack to a heap? But anyway, I don't want to dodge the question. I do find that difficult because a lot of it will be predicated by the mood of the fan base and things like that. And, you know, will they be really, really gunning for him or will it just be apathy? And I think that's what sunk Emery in the end was the apathy, actually, more than the anger. I think they rode the anger out. And then when it got to apathy, they're like, okay, we've let this go on too long. And, you know, the current Arsenal...
Well, wasn't it the dressing room with Emery, though, at the end of the day? Wasn't it like it was the fans, it was the media, but it was the dressing rooms, like,
yeah,
they just
but
died
then
I don't
think that necessarily, like, he was sacked in late November. I think that happened quite a long time before that,
like, yeah, like 6 months earlier.
I think everyone had been checked out, got their plane home.
And I guess my point is there's no way this team, is going to quit on him in a few games. You know what I mean?
Maybe not the whole squad, but the older players might.
Yeah.
Might. But I don't know, like looking at the Man City and Chelsea games, like you could make an argument. It's already started. Quite frankly, like I didn't see anything in those games that suggests they're really pulling for him either. I think it's too early to say they definitely down tools, but I didn't see a lot of togetherness in those games, so I think that is a situation that could escalate quickly. But look, yeah, like if he loses all of those games, then he's definitely gone.
Well, let me ask you, I can let you off the hook a little bit then, Tim. If it's not 12 points, if the results aren't brilliant, but the performances are substantially improved, is that enough for most fans at this point, or do you think it's gotten bad enough that it won't be enough to say, oh, well, I see we're playing better. Is it just results that can save him now?
It's just results. And I think you're right. I think with the fans anyway, he's in a jam to the point that it's not just results, it's results and performances that most people will want. And, you know, we have recent history, right, of Emery going on a massive 22-game unbeaten run. And there was this big split between those of us who are saying, yeah, but we've been a bit crap. And like loads of people saying, shut up, we're not losing.
We're winning. Well, shut up.
But then it's like we all saw how that turned out in the end. So maybe we're all wiser to, you know, things like underlying stats and, you know, just looking with your eyes and looking at the performances. So like I think Arteta needs both. That's not to say in the short term that they both have to be like amazing. Like there's going to be a bit of a slow recovery. Like I wouldn't expect us to go and beat Norwich 3 or 4 nil. Like I think we'll win that game, but I think it might be like a 1-0 or a 2-1 or something, because it will be slowly. But there has to be a direction of travel, definitely. And then it's just a case of how long, really, and what saves him. And ultimately, Elliot, in the medium term, I guess, like before Christmas, there is somewhere on this timeline before Christmas where Arsenal lose their patience, definitely. And it's just a case of when, and that might be a game or two either way, quite frankly.
The reason I picked that run of fixtures too is I sort of cheated, because three of the next five after that are Leicester, Liverpool, and United away. Mm. And so the reason I said it, I think it has to be almost basically 12 points in the run I picked, is because if it's not, that next run could get pretty ugly. And then you're looking at a run of 11 games where you're picking up 1 point a game, less than a point a game, right? That's where I think it's totally untenable. So we'll leave it there, because on Thursday we'll have a chance to look ahead to Norwich a little more and maybe tease this out. But whether you think he's really on the precipice or not at all, he's got this season. This is his project. Adu really did sort of say that they have the patience with him as well. I think it will be tested. I think what I'm learning from just sort of some of the negative reaction whenever you give him even any quarter, any excuse, is that people's patience for the excuses, even when they're legitimate, has dried up. So something has to change quickly now, and he's got a run where that change can happen. I feel like having the derby at home after two winnable games is maybe in his favor, because if he can win those two games, Burnley and Norwich, and then beat Spurs at home, that could go a long way to healing that wound I talked about in the last episode. But we'll see. We'll see what happens, and we'll have time to talk about it on Thursday, and we'll have a lot of content between now and then on the Patreon side as well. Bank holiday weekend here in the United States, Labor Day, to respect labor. So I hope you are not laboring wherever you are, and you're enjoying your day as summer turns to fall. Anyway, Tim's on Twitter. Roberto, thanks, Tim.
My pleasure, as always.
Paul's on Twitter. Pause my pants. Thanks, Pause.
Woohoo!
My name is Elliot Smith. You can block me on Twitter, Yankee Gunner. Once again, thank you so much to everyone who gave to the foundation fundraiser, and I hope you'll continue to do so throughout the month of September, and we'll smash that goal. And just a lot of good stuff coming. We're going to have a live event in London in October. We'll tell you more about that. It's going to be the weekend of the Palace game, which is on Monday. So we're working on putting that together, and hopefully we'll see a lot of you there. But I think we can leave it there. My name is Elliot Smith. I already told you that, but just in case you weren't sure, we love you. And we will talk to you after Arsenal 10, Norwich 0.